cavalry have moved off the battlefield, Sinn Scéir, Lella. Same as the treachery supposedly involved there. And they break. And up to that point, they probably inflicted more losses on the Williamites or allies who suffered, I'd imagine, in excess of 1,000, ultimately 1,000 killed. Up to that point, they had inflicted more casualties than they sustained. But then when they run, and it's in the pursuit by Danish and Dutch cavalry of those troops that try to flee across hedgerows and fields over just a period of an hour, because it's only an hour daylight left, that they would sustain another maybe, they would sustain 3,000-4,000 casualties in that pursuit. You see how it's what really matters is once the army breaks, that's when the casualties really happen.
One of the puzzles, I guess, then is why do some troops stand and some troops run, given that you're probably more likely to be killed if you run?
Well, rationality probably has very little to do with it. I suppose officers would try and persuade the troops, and they would. I mean, we know from some of the sample kind of harangues or pre-battle speeches that officers tell them, look, guys, you're safer if you stand together and fight together alongside each other than if you try and run. But to do that requires mutual trust, right? In that situation, the person who's the first to run towards the rear ranks will probably escape safe. You know what I mean? So for an individual, it seems to be a rational decision to run, whereas collectively it's a disastrous decision. But why would an army be more brittle, more likely to break? It might mean confidence in their leaders, it might mean the quality of their weapons, it might mean whether they've been fed that day or yesterday or the day before, it might mean their perception of the future, the experience of previous defeats, whether they think that the enemy are actually better and stronger than them, and so on. I mean, if you take Aucklin, for example, why would the Irish infantry have broken at that stage of the day? In fact, they stuck doggedly and counterattacked throughout that day, and really, you know, when you're looking for a reason, you're looking for the fact that their cavalry on their wings left them exposed, or certainly on one of the wings, on the left wing, and, you know, that's a fatal, once you see mutual trust breaking down, we've been abandoned by a unit on our left or on our right or whatever, then panic can take. So I suppose compared to, they need to be maybe more prone to panicking, whereas the English troops tended to be often more stolid. It's not that the English or Scots were, you know, particularly unbeatable, and there are many occasions when Irish armies defeated them, but they tended to have greater stolidity or endurance in adversity, and not to be as prone, even when things are going quite badly for them, they tended not to be as quickly, by and large, as quickly scattered and broken.
But probably the majority of casualties, certainly in the Nine Years' War and the Confederate Wars, were probably civilians. So what impact did warfare have on civilians in this day and age?
First of all, if you could imagine the sheer size of some of these armies. Now, I talked about, I'll give you an example of a joint Catholic Ulster and Leinster army that besieged Dublin, or kind of blockaded it in November, December 1647. If you include troops on both sides and the camp followers, and armies, early modern armies, had at least half as many camp followers with them. Women, washerwomen, nurses, do various duties, wives, camp wives, prostitutes, servant boys, horse boys. You had at least half as many, or maybe as many mouths with the army feeding as well. So you're looking at ambulatory cities. You take an army like that, that is bigger than any town in Ireland, any city in Ireland. And the same would be true in other countries. So you have walking cities without logistic or provisional arrangements. They keep moving, and they're like locusts, as it were, stripping a countryside bare. They're animals, they're cattle, certainly the Ulster army has herds of cattle going with them. So the passage of those armies is enormously destructive to agricultural communities, particularly if they do so more than once or twice. And that leaves, you know, the margin of comfort, which is never that high. I mean, the 1600s is a period classic case of the 30 Years' War in what we now call Germany. I mean, even 20th century historians reducing the earlier apocalyptic figures are still looking at, you're still talking about 30 to 40% population loss over that period. And that's not due to direct killing, for the most part, but due to the effect of disease.
Mm-hmm. But there is some direct killing of civilians in Ireland. I'm thinking particularly of two famous things, the 1641 rebellion and Cromwell's campaign when he takes Drogheda and Wexford.
Yeah, well, certainly the early of the 1640s months, to say the first 6 months of that war I was talking about, initially Catholic and Protestant, and then Protestant or government and Catholic, there are large-scale killings of civilians. And that settles down, and that becomes less common. Why? Because it's in nobody's interest. If you take the example of the government troops in early 1642, who are, you know, initially they kill the peasantry in Meath and Dublin, and then they realise, hang on a second, this is it, we're in for the long war here, we better encourage these people to stay, farm, feed us, and there isn't going to be an overnight reconquest. Do you see what happens? Once a war settles down to be in a longer phase, if only out of sheer practical necessity, ways of coping with that evolve, and it becomes in nobody's interest to kill civilians. I mean, these people are Christians as well. There are some moral restraints operating as well. What happens to Drogheda? Certainly in the case of Drogheda, I think Cromwell is trying to send out a message, and he's not sending it out by Western Telegraph. It's resistance will be met by terror. That's the message he's sending out, and he would have said himself that, yeah, this is, he would have implied a necessary evil. The effusion of blood would prevent the greater effusion, certainly, of English blood in the future. So he would have seen this as the lesser of evils. But it doesn't begin to compare with the impact on society of the indirect effect of warfare rather than the direct effect.
You've written about two battles in County Meath that are separated by 50 years, the Battle of Dungan's Hill and the Battle of the Boyne. One of them, Dungan's Hill, is almost completely forgotten. And the other one, the Battle of the Boyne, is very much remembered even now. So why do you think one of them is forgotten totally and the other one is remembered? Because probably more people died at Dungan's Hill.
Also, there's no probably about it. I'm pretty sure they did. Why are things forgotten and why are things remembered? Why would an Irish person constructing a